So our speaker today is Professor Peter Shore, who is currently the Henry Adams Moores and Henry Adams Moores Jr. Professor of Applied Mathematics in the Department of Math at MIT. Professor Shore is the winner of many prizes, including the Nevenlina Prize, a MacArthur Fellowship, and the Dirac Medal. As I'm sure many of you know, his discovery in 1994 of the algorithm for factoring prime numbers on a quantum computer played a key role in triggering the sort of current era of quantum computing excitement that we're living through. The following year, he made another important discovery with the first quantum error correcting code, which also, one could say, inaugurated a field or subfield, which increasingly seems like it will be important both for quantum computing as a technology, but also maybe increasingly likely as part of theoretical physics more broadly. And so today's talk is kind of a slightly belated 25th anniversary celebration of that discovery, and he'll be telling us about that topic, and we'll see what he says. Anyway, so Peter, please take it away.
Okay, can you see my screen? Okay.
Yes, so, yes, yeah.
Okay, and okay, so I will be talking about quantum error correction and fault tolerance. And this is work, or rather, I'm going to be reporting on a lot of work of other people, but I started this field. And the motivation was when I first discovered the quantum factoring algorithm in 1994, one reaction was that this would never work because of errors would inevitably disrupt the computation. So you can ask, how bad is the situation? Okay. To do 10 to the ninth steps on a quantum computer, which is, probably good for factoring small cryptographically significant numbers, you need to do each step with inaccuracy less than 10 to the minus ninth. And this seemed virtually impossible to experimental physicists at the time, and it still does. I mean, we've worked really, really, really hard since then and got the inaccuracy down from one part in maybe two to one part in 10 cubed, but one part in 10 to the ninth seems hopeless. Okay. The same objection was raised to scaling up classical computers in the 1950s, and von Neumann showed that you can give reliable classical protocols for doing classical computation reliably on unreliable classical components. And, what happened? Well, von Neumann didn't see this because he was thinking about vacuum tubes rather than transistors and integrated circuits, but what has happened is that we've developed extremely reliable chips, so we don't need any of these. We don't need that many of these techniques. So you can ask, can you use the classical fault tolerant techniques to make quantum computers error resistant? And for a few years, it looked like the answer was no. So why not? Well, there's a couple of no-go theorems here. One of them is the no-cloning theorem, which says you cannot duplicate an unknown quantum state. And another is the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which says you cannot completely measure an unknown quantum state. And so now we can look through these classical fault-tolerant techniques and ask, can they be applied to quantum computing? So the first one is checkpoint, and maybe that's the easiest one. When you're going through your computation, you periodically write down the state of your computation. So you can, if a computer fails later, you can go back to the last checkpoint. You don't need to go back to the beginning. Can you do this? And the answer is you can't clone a quantum state. So running down the state of your computation requires cloning quantum state because you want to keep the quantum state of your computation in the computation so you can proceed forward. So we can't do it. Then you can ask error correcting codes. What error correcting codes do is they, you know, you have your thing you want to, the bit string you want to put in memory, and you want to add a few redundant qubits so that if one or a few qubits has an error in it, you can still recover this original state. And that looks like it's cloning, but in fact, it's not. Error correcting codes work. And the last technique for classical fault tolerance is massive redundancy, where you keep many, many copies of your quantum classical state around, and then you keep comparing them against each other. And if some of them go bad, you use the majority to correct them. And the answer is, does this work? Not very well. And the reason is, if you have, say, 5 copies of your computer's quantum state, and one of them goes haywire, so now you're down to 4 copies, you want to take these 4 copies and put them back into 5. And taking 4 copies of a quantum state and making them 5 copies is cloning. So error correcting codes are the only techniques that work. And how well do they work? Well, you can show theorems like, if the quantum gates are accurate to 1 part in 10 squared, you can make fault tolerant quantum circuits. But if that's your error rate, the overhead is absolutely phenomenal. I mean, it's only a polynomial blow up in how many gates you need, but it's a ridiculous one. So if you have 1 part in 10 to the 4 error, it gives you much better overhead. But 1 part in 10 to the 4 error is really very difficult to achieve experimentally. None of the chips that have more than 2 qubits on them are anywhere near to 1 part in 10 to the 4 error. And the best upper bound is 1 part in 5, but that's, you know, only a proof we have that if it's your error rate is worse than 1/5, there's no way to do fault-tolerant quantum computation. So those are what the techniques will achieve right now. And it may be a moving target. So you can ask, what's the right threshold? And I'm not sure that's the right question, because it really depends very much on the architecture of your machine. And we don't know the architecture that will be used for quantum machines yet. So most of this talk will be explaining the techniques that go into the best mechanisms we know of for providing fault tolerance, which right now, you know, if you ask someone to design a machine for, you know, to do reliable computation on 1,000 logical qubits, it's going to have millions of physical qubits, and it's going to use these techniques. And these techniques are really, I mean, they're the best ones we have right now, but in some sense they're unsatisfactory because they have an enormous amount of overhead. And it's not clear at all that, you know, 5 years from now, someone might come up with a really clever idea and reduce this overhead dramatically, which will bring the time when we can do real full-scale quantum computation closer by 5 or 10 years, maybe even, if it's a dramatic enough improvement in fault tolerance. Okay, so first thing I'm going to do is do a little reminder about quantum mechanics. So what we're going to be using in this talk are von Neumann measurements. And if you have a quantum state space, which is a high dimensional complex Hilbert space, what a von Neumann measurement corresponds to is a complete set of orthogonal subspaces. So you have subspaces S1 through SK, and they span the entire space. And if we let pi sub si be the projection matrix onto the ith subspace, the von Neumann measurement corresponding to this collection of subspaces projects a quantum state onto the ith subspace with probability v pi s sub I v. And if you're not aware of this notation, v is a notation for a complex for a quantum state, which is just the complex vector in a Hilbert space, usually a unit vector. And this is the conjugate transpose of that vector, which is called a bra, so that together they make a bracket. And then after you project it, the state is the quantum state projected onto the subspace. And again, it should be normalized, I forgot that, so that it remains a unit vector. So there's a more general class of quantum measurements, but we're not going to talk about them in this talk. So let's go back to classical codes. The simplest classical code, which has probably been known for thousands of years, is just the repetition code. You take a bit zero, and you repeat it, say, three times, and you take a bit one, and you repeat it three times. And what about the quantum version? Well, I think in 1985 or so, Asher Perez was looking at quantum computers, and he was really looking at how you could do classical computation with quantum, dynamics. And he came up with this version: 0 goes to 000 and 1 goes to 111. So just the repetition code, except you make them quantum states. And what we're going to say is that we'll call 000 a logical 0 and 111 a logical 1. And this works against bit flips. So if you have a bit flip, which here is just Pauli matrix that turns a 1 to a 0 and a 0 to a 1, and if you apply it to the second qubit, then you get 010101. So can you correct this? Well, actually, it's fairly easy. You can measure which is different. And this measurement is a von Neumann measurement, which is a projection onto one of four two-dimensional subspaces, and they're generated by these vectors. And of course, these two vectors have the second bit different. So when you measure this one of these states, you get the answer, bit two is different. And now you can apply sigma x to the incorrect bit and correct the error. Okay, so this code also works on superpositions of quantum states. So here you have alpha times a logical zero plus beta times a logical one, and that's alpha 000 plus beta 111. And now if you have a bit error in the second bit, that's this Pauli matrix applied to the second bit, you get alpha 010 plus beta 101. Now, when you make the measurement, the result is bit two is flipped, but it projects it onto the quantum subspace containing these two vectors, which means that this state is not destroyed. So now, after you made the measurement, you can correct it by applying sigma x sub two. Okay, so this repetition code works against bit errors, but that's not the only kind of error there is in quantum computing. There's also phase errors. And in fact, a very important one is sigma z, which is another Pauli matrix, which is a phase flip error. And it takes a 1 to a minus 1 and a 0 state to a 0 state. So what happens when you make a phase flip error? Well, if you make a phase flip error on any of these three qubits, if you apply sigma z to, say, the third qubit, it takes 0 to 0, and it takes 1 to minus 1. So it takes a logical 0 to logical 0 and a minus 1 to a logical minus 1, or it takes a 1 to a logical minus 1. And that means that phase flips are three times as likely with the repetition code. And the same thing happens for a general phase error. If you have a 1 e to the I theta, this is a unitary matrix applied to one of the qubits. And if you have three phase errors, then the phase error in the encoded bit is the sum of the three phase errors on qubits 1, 2, and 3. So that means phase errors with this code behave like errors in analog computation. And errors in analog computation are well known to be almost impossible to correct. There are things you can do, but they don't really work very well at all. Okay. Now, what I realized, that there's another three-qubit code. You can take the unitary transform, and the way you get that is there's the unitary transformation that takes phase flips to bit flips and vice versa. And the reason it does that, if you apply a sigma H to a sigma X, you get a sigma Z and vice versa. So suppose we apply H to the three encoding qubits and the encoded qubit. What does this do to our code? Well, you get a new code. And I won't go into the arithmetic, but this is the code. And you can notice that zero is encoded by the superposition of all states with an even number of ones, and one is encoded by the superposition of states with an odd number of ones. So what does this mean if you have a bit flip? If you have a bit flip on any qubit, well, that exchanges zero and one for that qubit. So it takes a logical zero to a logical one and vice versa. So you make bit flips three times as likely. And the other thing is a phase flip on any qubit is correctable, which is exactly what you would expect because we applied the Hadamard transformation that took bit flips to phase flips and vice versa. But the way this works is if you apply a phase flip to bit three, say, you change the elements of the, you put a minus sign on the elements of the superposition that have a one in bit three. And this is orthogonal to, well, it's orthogonal to all phase flips on other qubits, and it's orthogonal to a phase flip on an encoded one. So these are, you know, all orthogonal states. So you can measure this, or rather, you can measure which bit has a phase flip on it using a von Neumann measurement. And then once you get this measurement, the result of this measurement, you can correct it by applying the phase bit to that bit. So it's just like the bit error flip error correcting code, except for phases. Okay, so what have we done? Well, I mean, this was, you know, so I realized this, and now it looks like we're stuck. You have a three-qubit code, which protects against bit errors and make phase errors more likely. But now what you can do is you can kind of squeeze this code or something and protect it, make it protect against phase errors, but that makes bit errors more likely. But what we really want to do is protect against both phase errors and bit errors. So what do we do? Well, the answer is we combine the code to get a nine-qubit code. So suppose we want to encode a qubit with this nine-qubit code. First, we encode the qubit using one of these three-qubit codes. Then now we have three qubits. Now each of these resulting qubits we encode using the other three-qubit code. So now we have nine qubits. And the really nice thing is that this code protects against both phase errors and bit errors. And this is called concatenating the codes. And you know, concatenating codes is a standard operation in classical coding theory. So I didn't make any great discoveries by finding it. I just applied it to quantum error correcting codes. And so here is the first quantum error correcting code. And this code will correct any error in one of the nine qubits. And you can see zero is a superposition of an odd number, an even number of these triplets of ones, and one is a superposition of an odd number of these triplets of ones. And the outer code corrects phase errors, outer code being the first one you encode, and the inner code corrects bit errors. And if you have a bit flip, it's corrected by comparison with the other two qubits in its group of three. So that works. And if you have a phase flip, it gives the same result as a phase flip on any of the other qubits in the same group of three, and you correct it just exactly the way you did for the three-qubit error correcting code. So now we have a qubit. And the other thing you can notice is if you have a sigma y, which is a third Pauli matrix, that's just I times the product of sigma x and sigma z. So you can also correct sigma y's, which you can think of as being a bit flip combined with a phase flip. So we have a code that corrects one error of any of the type of the three Pauli matrices. But, you know, you can object. That's not all the errors. I mean, this is just three specific errors. And really, there are an uncountable number of errors you can apply to a single qubit. You can apply an arbitrary unitary matrix. You can apply an arbitrary measurement. And you can ask, can these all be corrected? And the answer is yes. And the reason is this beautiful theorem. If you can correct a tensor product of T or fewer errors on any of the following three types, which are the three types of errors that I showed the 9-qubit code corrected, then you can fix any error restricted to T qubits. And when T is 1, you can apply this theorem directly to this 9-qubit code and show that it corrects an error on any single qubit. Okay, so how do we prove the theorem? Well, I'm not going to go into the gory details of the proof. I'm going to illustrate how it works for the phase error correcting code and just, you know, wave my hands here. So the identity matrix and sigma x, sigma y, sigma z. So we know we can correct no error, and that's the identity matrix, form a basis for all 2x2 matrices. So you can decompose any error matrix into the sum of these four matrices. And if you have a tensor error applied to T qubits, then you can decompose it into the tensor product of T of these errors. And we know we can correct those. So that means we can correct all of them, all errors on fewer than T qubits. And how does this really work? Well, what we're going to do is we're going to apply a general phase error to the phase error correcting code on 3 qubits and show that it works. So suppose we apply this general phase error to qubit 1. So that's the first qubit here. What happens? Well, first, quantum mechanics says that global phases are immaterial. They don't really change the way a state behaves. And if you're a philosopher, you can say that they don't actually affect the state. So we're going to rewrite the error as e to the minus I theta and e to the I theta. And then we apply this to our logical zero. And it goes to, well, we get an e to the minus I theta applied to terms of the superposition with a zero, and an e to the I theta applied to terms in the superposition of 1. And now we can rewrite that with e to the I theta equals cos theta plus I sine theta, and we get this thing. Okay, and here we are. We took a logical zero to cos theta times this state and minus I sine theta times this state. And now what we're going to do is we're going to try correcting this with our standard correction protocol, which means we project it onto one of 4 spaces. And, you know, you can see that this state is our logical zero with no errors. And this state is our logical zero with a Pauli matrix. A full phase flip applied to the first qubit. So when we measure this, it gets projected onto one of these 2 states. You get the first state with cosine probability cos squared theta, and the second state with probability sine squared theta. And, but after it's projected, that's actually the correct state. So we will get no error with probability cos squared theta and error on bit 1 with probability sine squared theta, and then we can correct it. And that's exactly how we can correct errors on arbitrarily many qubits or rather on t or fewer qubits, we correct errors perfectly. So we can handle arbitrary errors on up to t qubits if we find a quantum t qubit error correcting code. How about small errors on every qubit, which is actually what's going to happen? Well, what you do is you expand the errors in a Taylor series. So you can take each error and you can say, this is a superposition of the identity with some large probability, say 0.99, and 0.05, there's an error in the first qubit. I mean, there's a sigma x error, and 0.04, there's a sigma y error, etc. And then you expand all these terms, and when you measure them, nearly all the time, you're going to get an error with t or fewer qubits. So it will correct it. And there's a small chance that your error will not be corrected. But if your error rate is small enough and your code is good enough at correcting errors, no, there will be an exponentially small probability that you'll get an error that you won't correct, and you can not worry about that. So quantum error correcting codes correct lots of errors. And now we can answer the question, how did we get around the Heisenberg uncertainty principle? Which is, if you measure the state of the system, you disturb the state of the system. Well, what we do is we measure the error, assuming it falls into some set of likely errors, so errors that affect fewer than t qubits, and we don't measure the encoded quantum state. So then we can correct the error without actually disturbing the encoded quantum state. And so this requires us to find codes where the likely errors are orthogonal to the encoded state. Okay. So you can look back at classical coding theory, and, you know, it was only in 1950 or so that someone discovered you could do better than the repetition code. I mean, the repetition code has the big problem that the better you want your state to be transmitted, the less likely of having an error in your transmission, the longer you have to make your encoded message. But there are codes that do much better than the repetition code. So the first of these to be discovered was discovered by Hamming, and it's called the 743 Hamming code. Four meaning, you know, that there are encodes 4 bits. Seven meaning that encodes the 4 bits into 7 bits. And 3 meaning that the minimum distance between any 2 code words is 3, so it can correct 1 error. And I won't explain this, but that's what the 3 is. And so the quantum analog of the 3-bit repetition code is a 9-qubit code that can correct an error in 1 qubit. So can you make better quantum error correcting codes? Well, the answer is yes. And to do this, let's look at this Hamming code. So the code is the row space of this matrix G. And to correct errors, what we do is we use the parity check matrix H, which is the set of all, well, it's a generator matrix. The dual code of C is a set of all vectors which are orthogonal to all of the code words in C. And this is a generator matrix for the dual code, which is also known as the parity check matrix. And what this means, what the dual means, is that H times V equals 0 if V is in the code. And we will call HV the syndrome, and that will tell us the location of the errors. And I'm going to go into how you use the syndrome, because it turns out to be almost exactly the same as how you use the syndrome for quantum codes. So recall that we have a generator matrix G and a parity check matrix H, and they generate dual codes, which means that G times H transpose is 0. So you start off with a message M, you encode it, and that means you multiply M by the generator matrix G, and you get a code word that is in the code. And now, of course, an error comes along, and you can represent the error as adding something, adding a vector with a small number of ones because it's a small error to MG. And now, how do we correct it? Well, what we do is we multiply by H transpose. And remember, G H transpose was zero, so M G H transpose is zero. So we just get E times H transpose. So the syndrome depends only on the error. And this is why it's called the syndrome, because you can use it to diagnose the error. So in general, if you have an arbitrary linear code, finding the error from the syndrome is hard. So to actually have useful codes, you need to find codes where you can find the error from the syndrome in general, efficiently. And people have been figuring out how to do this better and better since 1950. And we finally got, I wanted to say that we finally got the ultimate answer in 2010 with polar codes, but actually that's probably not true because it's the ultimate answer asymptotically. But if you have small code lengths, maybe you can still do better. So this is how classical code works. Well, what about quantum codes? Are there better codes than the repetition code? Well, I started playing around with them, and I came up with this code, which you can see comes from the Hamming code. These 16 bit strings are all code words of the Hamming code, and we take the superposition of the ones in this parity check thing, which is the dual code of the Hamming code, and then the ones which are the coset of the ones in H, which means we take H and we add 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1 to all of the vectors here, and we get these. Okay, so that is the quantum Hamming code. So why is it correctable? Well, all of these elements of the superposition are in the classical Hamming code. And now if you measure the syndrome, which is just a very simple quantum circuit, it will tell you which bit to correct. And then you can apply, if you have a sigma x error applied to one of these qubits, you can apply that sigma x error from the syndrome and correct it. Well, how about phase flip errors? Well, remember we had this Hadamard matrix, and it really should have a 1 over root 2 in front of it. I'm sorry. And if you apply this Hadamard matrix to all 7 encoding qubits and to the encoded qubit, it takes the code to itself. And that means that once you've applied this Hadamard matrix to all of those qubits, bit flip errors look like phase flip errors and vice versa. So now you can correct bit flip errors on this code as well. Okay. And now you can generalize this construction by staring at it for a long while and figuring out what makes it work. And this gives CSS codes. And these were discovered simultaneously by Rob Calderbeck and me, and also by Andrew Steen. And I'm not sure this is going to make sense to people who don't know some coding theory, but suppose we have two weakly dual codes, C1 and C2 dual. And that means that the weakly dual means that if X is in C1 and Y is in C2 dual, then X dot Y equals zero. And that means C2 is a subset of C1. Now we define code words corresponding to the cosets of C2 and C1. So if you want to have a non-trivial code, C2 had better be strictly contained in C1. And for a coset X plus C2, we just take the superposition of everything in that coset to be our code word. And the theorem is if C1 can correct T1 errors and C2 dual, there's a perpendicular sign missing here, can correct T2 errors, then the CSS code can correct T1 bit errors and T2 phase errors. Okay, so now the thing comes down to looking for two classical binary codes which are weakly dual and are both good codes. And coding theorists, you know, since 1950 have done exhaustive theoretical studies of codes, and there were lots and lots and lots and lots of these pairs of codes known, so you can just pick them and come up with a good quantum code. And now you can ask, well, is there anything better than this? Well, excuse me. So two groups at IBM and Los Alamos discovered a 5-qubit code using computer search. And actually, they weren't exactly the same 5-qubit code, but they could both be turned into this nice symmetric version of it just by applying Pauli matrices to the qubits and things like that, and shuffling the qubits. So, you know, with Calderbank, Eric Raines, and Neil Sloan, I discovered the structure behind this code and generalized it to another wide class of nice quantum codes. And this was discovered simultaneously by Daniel Gottesman. And what was this code? Well, one interesting thing was how I discovered this structure. I asked Neil Sloan how you could find the size of the symmetry group of this code. And he gave an example from some research that he was working on where he had used the computer program Magma to compute a symmetry group. And so I took his example and I, you know, did the program for this code, and it gave us the same number of elements in the symmetry group, which was 190 million or so. And then we looked at it closer, it was the same group. And in fact, there was a very close connection between the problem that Neil Sloan was working on and quantum codes. So we exploited that to give the codes. And it's a stabilizer construction, and this 5-qubit code is actually the subspace generated by the code words is a subspace of states left invariant by the following 4 unitary transformations. And these transformations all commute, and so they have a simultaneous eigenspace, so you can make the subspace well-defined. And you can see that they commute because if you look at 2 of them, here sigma x and sigma z are here, and there's another sigma z and sigma x. And sigma x sigma z equals minus sigma z sigma x. So when you take this and commute it with this, you get 2 minus signs, so it's +1, so it commutes. And the same for all the other pairs of these elements in the stabilizer. So that's how the stabilizer construction works. And we can go back and look at the Hamming code. And this code consists of the code words that are simultaneous eigenvalues of these 6 operators. And you can see that these correspond to these guys. You take a 1 here and turn it into a sigma z, and then take a 1 and turn it into a sigma x, and you get this state and this state. And so this shows you that CSS codes are also stabilizer codes. And now, in fact, this will let you find the logical operator to apply a sigma x to your qubit. It's just sigma x to the 7th, and the logical operator for sigma z is sigma z tensored with itself 7 times. And these two things commute with all elements of the stabilizer, which means that they take code words in the code to code words in the code, but they don't commute with each other, which means they have non-trivial operations on the code words. And because they anti-commute, one of them, I mean, you can let one of them be the sigma x operator applied to the logical zero, and the other, the sigma z operator applied to the logical zero. Okay, so that is going to be important for our next discussion, which is I'm going to tell you about toric codes. So the big, most common code that people think, or the code that people most commonly think is going to be used for large scale quantum computers, is something called the surface code. And it's not going to be exactly this surface code because they found better ones, but they all are quite similar. And so I'm going to go through the, classical, historical discovery of surface codes. And that was done by Alexei Kitaev, who came up with the toric code. And the toric code is generated by a stabilizers. And now we want to say which elements of the state of this. Okay, so this is an n by n grid. There's a qubit on each edge, and we want to say which qubits are sigma z's in the elements of the stabilizer and which are sigma x's. And the answer is we have, for every square or every plaquette here, there's an operator which is a sigma z on all the four edges of the plaquette. And for every vertex, there's an operator that is sigma x on all four edges of the vertex. And you can see these commute because if they're not disjoint, they have to look like this, where the square is in one corner of the vertex operator. And now the square and the operator and the vertex operator share two edges. And that means they commute because each of these edges, when you commute this blue square, this red vertex operator, you get a minus one for each of these two edges, and they multiply and come up with a one. And I should say that in the next things, blues are always going to be sigma z's and reds are always going to be sigma x's. Okay, so this is the toric code. And you can see that the stabilizer contains n squared minus one linearly independent plaquette operators. I mean, there are n squared plaquette operators, but if you apply them all, you get the identity operator. So there's only n squared minus one linearly independent ones and n squared minus one linearly independent vertex operators. And that means that the number of qubits this code encodes is 2n squared, which is the number of qubits it has, the number of edges, minus 2 times n squared minus 1. So it's 2 qubits. So what are these 2 qubits? Well, I will tell you the logical sigma z operators and the logical sigma x operators on these two qubits, because it's really very difficult to describe these two qubits in as superpositions of states. So the logical sigma z operator, one of them is a chain of blue edges, or sigma z's, from the top to the bottom. And there's another one that's a chain of sigma z's from the left to the right. And the sigma x operators are a chain of red edges from the left to the right. And it doesn't matter which path you pick from the top to the bottom, because you can get from one path to the another by applying these stabilizer elements, which is just all the blue edges around a square. And when you apply all the blue edges around a square, you get, that does not change the logical sigma z. And you can see that any blue path from the top to the bottom must intersect a red path from left to right. So that means these two operators anti-commute. So one of these is the logical sigma z on one of the qubits, and the other is the logical sigma x on that qubit. So it encodes two qubits. And now you can ask, how do you correct errors on a toric code? Well, so the way you correct errors is you measure the syndrome, which is you measure whether for each of these elements in the stabilizer, so all of the n squared minus one Plaquette operators and all of the n squared minus one Friedrichs operators, which of them actually have a minus one as an eigenvalue rather than a one. So they're all should be ones as an eigenvalue if you're in the code. So you measure which ones are not satisfied. And now I'll just worry about the Friedrichs operators because the edge the Plaquette operators work exactly the same way. Well, you're going to get some elements of the stabilizer that are not satisfied. How do you correct them? Well, you want to correct them with the most probable error that generates these. And the most probable error that generates these is the shortest blue path that connects, you know, these. So if you have a blue path, if you apply these two blue sigma z operators, then you make this stabilizer operator be a minus one, have a one eigenvalue instead of a minus one, because this does not commute with a path from here to here, and it commutes with all the other Friedrichs operators. And again, you want to find the shortest path, set of paths that connect all of these Friedrichs operators. So that's the most likely error. And you just apply this, and then you correct the error. Okay. Now there's a problem with toric codes, which is you cannot put torices on flat chips. So what do we do? Well, what you can do is you can have a smooth edge and a rough edge. And now we get the logical operators are blue paths connecting the two smooth edges and red paths connecting the two rough edges. And, you know, these any blue path from here to here and a red path from here to here, any commute. So you can see that these are indeed the logical sigma z and the logical sigma x. Okay. Let's see, how much more time do I have? 10 minutes?
Yes, about.
Okay, so I have a lot more slides. So let's see. So I'm going to skip some of them. So a quantum gate is a 2x2 or 4x4 vector space that applies to 2 qubits or 1 qubit on your computer. So if you have 2 qubits, that's a 4-dimensional vector space. So you have a linear transformation on this vector space. That's a matrix. That's a 2-qubit gate. And as in classical computing, you know, you only need AND gates and NOT gates to do arbitrary computations. The same thing is true on quantum computers. And what you need are control NOT gates, π/8 gates, and 1/√2 Hadamard gates, which we've already seen. So what we need to do is we need fault-tolerant quantum circuits that implement the gates on encoded qubits. So how do we make fault-tolerant error correction circuits? Well, classically, this is von Neumann's massive redundancy. You take two bits that are encoded by a repetition code, you apply an AND to pairs of them, and now you get your new encoded bit, and you see that, you know, there are some errors that come in because you had an error in the original state. There are some errors that come in because this gate made an error. So after you do that, you have to do an error correcting step where you clean up and you hope to fix more errors than you make in your error correction step. And then you keep repeating. And of course, if you have really good gates, you don't need to do this error correction step every single time you apply a gate. You can do it, you know, just every so often. The same thing is true for quantum computing. You need to have 2 qubits here encoded in a quantum error correction code. And now you do some kind of circuit, which applies the operation on the encoded qubits, and then you do a correction step, which hopefully corrects more errors than it makes, and then you keep on doing this. And the really nice thing about CSS codes and surface codes is that certain gates can be implemented transversally. So for example, to do a C0 on the encoded qubits A and B, you take the C0 of the ith qubit encoding A with the ith qubit encoding B, and now you get a C0 operation on the encoded bits. And this transversal operation, which you can see here, we're just connecting the ith qubit of this quantum error correction code to the ith qubit of this quantum error correction code, is guaranteed never to let an error in the ith bit out of the ith bit of the resulting encoded logical qubits. So that means it's automatically fault tolerant. Your errors will never multiply too much. Okay. And you can do a transversal C0 on the Hamming code. Let X bar be all ones or all zeros, whether X or zero. And recall that our encoded qubit on the Hamming code was X bar plus H, where H is this subcode of the code. And that's just sum over all V in H, X bar plus V. So what happens when we do a transversal C0 gate between two of these things? Well, you get 1 over H here, and then a C0 of X bar plus V and Y bar plus W. And to do an X C0 on these two bit strings, you just do a C0 on each of these bit strings because that's transversally. So you get X bar plus V here. Here you get X bar plus Y bar plus D plus W, where plus is, I should say, the exclusive R operation, the binary plus. But this turns out to be just X bar plus Y bar plus W because V is an element of your coset and W is an element of your coset. So if you're summing over all W in your coset and you add B to that, that's also the sum over all W in your coset. So this does the transversal not C0 gate between two of these. And so there are lots of gates that can be implemented transversely, but you can show that you cannot do everything transversally. There's a theorem that says you cannot use transversal gates for all the gates in a set of universal gates. So what do you do? Well, we need to find some fault-tolerant subcircuits for finding gates that you cannot do transversally. And this nice thing is called magic states. So you can show that if you can implement pi over 8 gates fault-tolerantly, if you can manufacture a certain helper quantum state, and the helper quantum state, I mean, if you want to apply this non-Clifford gate, the helper quantum state is this, cos pi over 8, 0, plus sine pi over 8, 1. And there is a way to take 7 of these states that are close to this, where you are pi over cos pi over 8, logical 0, plus sine pi over 8, logical 1, and apply a measurement. And if you're lucky, which if these are all close, you're very likely to be lucky, you get 1 qubit, which is much closer than these things. So you can distill good magic states from a lot of bad magic states. And that's magic state distillation. And I am going to skip to, I guess, the second to last slide and say that this disadvantage of using surface codes and magic states is the amount of overhead. So surface codes are inefficient because 1 qubit is encoded using 2k squared physical qubits, that's one. And magic states are inefficient because you need to create lots and lots and lots of imperfect magic states before you can distill them into a few nearly perfect magic states. So if you try to design a large-scale quantum computer for using magic states and surface codes, it turns out that nearly all of your resources go into these things called magic state factories, which make magic states and supply them for doing these non-Clifford gates. And that's the problem. Are there better ways to do this? We don't know, but some people are trying to figure out them out. And I think that's probably a good place to end my talk.
Okay, well, feel free to unmute to thank Peter for a great talk. And can I start by asking if there are any questions from students? Any students in the audience want to venture a question? Going once. Does anyone else have a question? Peter, it was so clear that you have stumped the audience. They have no questions. I was curious to see what you were going to say right at the end of your talk. What are the two following slides here that didn't get mentioned?
Okay, well, I was going to say something about ideas for non-surface codes, and let's see. One very interesting class of non-surface codes is LDPC codes. And you can make these with hypergraph products. And these were originally discovered in, I guess, 2009. But there's been a lot of recent work, some very recent work, which improves them. So is a interesting question is it impossible to use these hypergraphic product LDPC codes for fault-tolerant quantum computation? And one big problem is that, as far as we know, they're not embeddable in the plane, so you don't get this really nice correspondence of a planar computer chip with a planar array of qubits. And so that may be a problem with this hypergraph product, unless someone can come up with hypergraph product codes that are more or less planar. And there are also topological quantum computation codes where you have a Hamiltonian, and this Hamiltonian actually implements topological quantum field theory, and then you can do quantum computation. In this topological quantum field theory, there are quasi-particles, which are excitations, which you can call anions. And you can do quantum computation by braiding these anions around each other and see what happens when you fuse them. And, I think this is a really interesting area, although, right now, it doesn't look like there's any way to do practical quantum computation with these things that's better, has better performance than surface codes.
Maybe one other question, thank you, would be about, there has been work over the past maybe 5 or 10 years having to do with reinterpreting the relationship between the way information is encoded in holography on the bulk and in the boundary, relating it to quantum error correcting codes. Have you followed that, and do you have anything to say about it?
I followed that, and it's really fascinating, but I want to say that these quantum error correcting codes for relating, ADS, CFT, bulk boundary things, they're all look like toy models so far. They don't tell you anything, or they don't tell you very much about what the real quantum codes that are that you would see in actual string theory there. They're just more or less toy models that show that it might be possible to do it in principle. So we really need a lot more work before we learn something fundamental about string theory from this, I think.
Okay. Did any other questions crop up during the during that subsequent interval?
I have a question.
Go for it.
Yeah, so pretty much everything that you talked about today, I think that stuff was mostly hardware agnostic. So it doesn't really matter if the qubits are superconducting, semiconducting, ion traps, whatever. So do you know of any approaches to error correction that can maybe take the hardware into account and you use it as an advantage? So hardware specific error correction.
Well, there's a group at Yale, including Shruti Puri, who are doing very interesting stuff with harmonic oscillators and superconducting qubits with transmons. And I haven't really followed it very well so far, but that's definitely hardware related quantum error correction.
Okay, thanks.
Anyone else?
Maybe just one quick question. So at the start, near the start of the talk, you said there was an upper bound on the threshold of like 1/5. Where does that come from?
Well, let's see. I am trying to remember. This was a while ago, and I think it comes from an entropy consideration. If you have enough errors on your quantum computing, you need, so error increases entropy. And you need to get rid of this entropy somehow in your quantum computation. And, if you have you have to assume that you have some set of gates. And if you have a set of gates, only a certain amount of speed with which you can get rid of this entropy. And if your gates are noisier than the speed you get rid of the entropy, then you just get more and more entropy in your quantum computer. And eventually it's just too noisy to tell anything. So the idea is that if you have a given set of gates, there's only, and of course you have to have measurements as well, there's only a certain rate at which you can dissipate entropy from your quantum computer. And if your gates are noisy enough that they generate entropy higher than this rate, there's nothing you can do. So I guess 1/5 is really also very model dependent, because it requires some assumption on which gates you have and everything.
Great, thanks.
Maybe one last question then. So a lot of the talk was a very nice review of the early days of quantum error correction. If you had to point us to one or two most exciting recent results in this area, does anything come to mind?
There's a lot of I've forgotten the name of it. There's a way of correcting error. There's a better way of correcting errors with flag qubits. And those can improve the performance of error correction by quite a bit. So that's one thing that's exciting recently. Other things that are exciting recently is, these LDPC codes that I mentioned at the end. There's a lot of recent results about them. There's another thing which just came out, I think, a couple of weeks ago or something, which is, I guess, there's this Australian student who was an undergrad, discovered by just tweaking the surface code quite slightly, you can get it to do a lot better performance. I think it's called the XZZX model. And, you know, that's very similar to the surface code, but it works a lot better. So.
Okay, great. Thank you for, thanks for this. Okay, well, if there are no further questions, then let's thank Peter one more time for a great talk.